Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. In our last podcast, we brought you Rob Sitch, who plays the man at the centre of the fictional nation-building authority in the satirical program Utopia. The authority oversees infrastructure projects. Today, we're moving from fiction to the real thing. We have with us the Federal Minister for Infrastructure, Darren Chester, a national who sits in the cabinet. Darren Chester, I have to start by asking you whether you watch Utopia and how do you react?
I must say Utopia is probably my favourite show on TV at the moment. I've enjoyed the last few immensely. I've got to say, though, sometimes a little too close to home. There was an episode recently where they couldn't find the minister because he was out on a farm run. And my staff told me they often can't find me if I'd snuck up in the morning for a quick jog. So I enjoy Rob Sitch's humour. I think the good thing about the program is it almost always ends in a problem. You know, they seem to resolve the problem. Just the process of getting there is a bit ugly sometimes.
Well, sort of resolved. Sometimes it's more an illusion than a reality, which I guess you find in politics too.
Well, I guess to learn the old saying that other policies are a bit like sausages. You don't want to see them actually made. It's a funny program. It does take the mickey out of Australian political life, but I think most people enjoy it. There's a good send-up of our bureaucrats and the politicians themselves.
Now, to be serious, the Melbourne to Brisbane Inland Railway has always been a dream of the Nationals, and the government is now committed to it. Where are we up to with this project, and what's the timetable?
Well, you're right, it has been a dream of the Nationals for a long time. In fact, it's been a dream of the regional Australians for a very long time. It's been talked about for decades. It's quite fitting, I guess, in this year when we celebrate the 100th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railway, so the railway line that went from east to west. Now we're getting on the job with building the railway line that goes from north to south. And what we'll see is a freight link between Melbourne and Brisbane, which will allow us to more efficiently move products up and down the coast. We expect the freight task to grow enormously over the next decade. And this is about providing a safer link. We'll see some of the heavy vehicle traffic move on the rail, which will improve road safety, which is a personal passion of mine. Where we're at in terms of the project, we're going through the process with all the states, at least the three states, to get agreements with them to get access their legal capacity for acquisition of land. It's an important part of the process that the three states work together with the Commonwealth. And we're going to see some construction work later on this year and again really ramping up next year, particularly in New South Wales.
Now, the critics would see this as a project that's more electoral than economic, with the route going through a number of coalition seats. Despite the benefits you mention, is it really going to contribute a great deal to the economy in net terms?
Well, absolutely. This is the type of project that I think governments are ideally suited to doing. The private sector obviously can make investments where they can see a quick return. The governments have the capacity to invest for longer term. But I think it's a good example of a project that our people are going to be the bankers for. I look back in decades to come and say, well, whether they made that decision in 2017 to finally go on with that railway, it will mean that we'll be able to more efficiently access world markets. And, you know, one of the great successes of this government has been the free trade agreements negotiated in the previous term. Getting our products to market is critical and doing it efficiently through freight things like that metal building on rail, I think is key. And the social benefits in terms of reducing road trauma are going to be very clear for everyone to see. So, yes, I think there are social benefits, there's economic benefits, there's environmental benefits as well in terms of moving freight on rail to more environmentally sustainable movement on double road.
I think that people in the voter land often get a bit bamboozled by the whole infrastructure debate. There are huge numbers, projects seem to be announced and then re-announced, and it's all a bit confusing. But the opposition argues that the government has marginalised Infrastructure Australia in favour of a more political approach, including by setting up a financing body in the Prime Minister's department. In general, do you think government should wait for Infrastructure Australia before making commitments? And should Infrastructure Australia's recommendations be accepted, prima facie at least?
Part of the challenge of infrastructure is the scale of the project is enormous, and almost inevitable that an infrastructure project will go outside the electoral cycle. So one government or one minister may make an announcement, and then a future government may have the responsibility that should be in that project. So they are of longer term nature, and I think one of the challenges for me as a minister in the time that I've filled the role is making sure that there's a level of transparency in how decisions are made, so that any decision you do make made to stand the change of future fortune so that people see the merit in those projects. And I think taking infrastructure out of that short-term political cycle and recognising we're doing things now, building things that our future generations will benefit from, is the key to doing a good job in this role. So in terms of infrastructure, Australia, I think it provides a good independent sounding board for the projects. And it's $100 million in terms of infrastructure Australia for us. I think that's an important part of the process. But inevitably, you'll find that given our nature of government, the three levels of government, local and state government will identify priorities and they'll come to us seeking funding at some stage in the process. The whole point of the Prime Minister's decision and the move to have the IPFA established is about engaging the Commonwealth earlier in the process.
That's this unit in the Prime Minister's department we're talking about.
That's right. So the new unit is all about identifying early in the process where there's opportunities for the private sector to build some infrastructure, to work with government. We have a very long list of projects that people put to us as a government. We don't have the capacity in the current budget to fund all of them, so the IPFA, the approach taken by the PM and this government, is all about seeing opportunities for private sector investments to take some of the pressure off the public monitoring.
Now, you talk about projects going beyond the electoral cycle and the political processes that are involved. We've seen stoushes between the government and state Labor governments, notably the Victorian government, where a lot of money has been sacrificed because there was a standoff over a project. When there are disagreements, which level of government should have the last say?
Well, the issue that they're doing is primarily this listening project in Victoria. And that is an extraordinary example of what can go wrong in an infrastructure project. It introduced for the first time in Australia an element of sovereign risk, where a company was contracted to do a job for the East Listening Project by the former Liberal National Coalition government. And the incoming Labor government tore up the contract and spent $1 billion of taxpayers' money to not build the road. Now, that's an appalling set of circumstances, one we won't never see repeated again. So I think we've got to engage early in the process with the states, and I work with my Labor colleagues at state level very well. We've got a project we're going to agree on, we'll get on with the job and start building them. If there's ones we can't agree on, then that's a matter for other governments to deal with at a future stage. But we've got to try and work as much as possible across party lines and think of a longer term how we're using taxpayers' money to achieve value for dollar, but also have that longer term view. And that's one of our great challenges in Australian political life right now. Is getting outside the short-term cycle, thinking longer-term, and working as constructively as we can across those political boundaries.
So are you saying, perhaps beyond this portfolio, that there's just too much hyper-partisanship in Australian politics at the moment?
Absolutely. I think in the last 8 or 9 years, we've been through a period of Australian political life which has been deeply troubling for anyone who is passionate about our nation and concerned about its future. What we've been through is a hyper-partisan period, and I'd like to see it settle down to getting on to making good long-term decisions in the nation's interest. I put the challenge out to the Labor Party to think a little bit about some of the things they're opposing at the moment and work your way through the fact that the challenges we face economically and with the budget are going to be challenges they might face one day if they take over this role of being in government. So we've got to work together wherever we can. There's always going to be areas of political difference, that's inevitable. But some of the short-term decisions that have been made by Labor to oppose Proposition SAFE, I don't think will be well rewarded in the future.
But what's good for the goose is good for the gander, surely, and it's a challenge for your side as well.
Absolutely. It's a challenge across the political class. Where we have areas that we need to work together in the long-term interest of the nation, we should be doing it. And there's areas of division, obviously, we try and work them out, but we should have a public debate which is respectful and moderate in its tone. I think that the tone of debate in Australia has deteriorated recently, and we've shown ourselves incapable of having a good, rational debate on constant issues, and it's led to some poor policy.
Now, talking about partisanship, what about the partisanship within the coalition itself? Is there a natural rivalry between sitting Liberals and the Nationals between spending on urban transport and on country roads, for example, and can this distort priorities?
I'm not sure if I'd call it a rivalry as such. I think there's inevitably a competing tension where we're competing for a limited amount of funding and seeking to make sure that those of us who are passionate about regional areas, whether they're Liberals or Nats, we want to see a fair share of that money make it out to our regional community. So there is a tension there, inevitably, but I don't think it's a bad thing in the sense that we're working to try and secure good results for our community, which, after all, is a regional centre in the first place.
Now, you recently announced in an inquiry into road safety and flagged concerns about a rise in road deaths. What do you think will be found to be the biggest risk factors that have caused this reversal of the trend downwards in earlier years?
Well, it's a good question. In the 1970s, we had a death toll in Australia in the order of 3,000 per year. And we've been very successful as a nation and even at state level to introduce legislation like compulsory wearing seatbelts, breath testing for alcohol, speed limits on open roads, all these things that help to reduce our road trauma. But in the last couple of years, we've seen a bit of a spike and it concerns me deeply. And I simply don't accept that in 2017 another 1,300 Australians have to die on our roads. And we need to work as much as we can with the state government, with police and with the community to put down the pressure on road trauma. Now, I think some of them have changed in recent times, particularly involved around driver distraction and using mobile phones in cars. I think that's showing up as an area of concern. And in Victoria last year and in the previous year, there's actually more people who died on the roads with illicit substances, so drugs in their system, rather than excessive alcohol. So that's a trend to worry about as well. So we need to do more roadside testing for the use of illicit drugs. We need to get the message out there about mobile phones and the impact it has on driver distraction. And there's the old issues of speed and fatigue, always playing with. But it's not just about drivers. I think governments have to take responsibility too in terms of building better and safer roads. And that's why I really like our projects like the Black Spots program and other programs that actually improve the safety of the road itself, so that drivers who may make mistakes may not end up seriously injured as a result.
On the drugs, is this a problem in the transport industry, or is this more with just ordinary drivers, you know, transport drivers who are trying to keep awake?
I think the transport sector itself, the heavy vehicle sector, has worked very hard to stamp out the use of substances like that. I'm talking more about recreational drugs, so-called recreational drugs, so we're talking methamphetamine, cannabis, opioids, that type of thing. It's showing up in the testing as being a problem for us now. It's a challenge for us to get a cheap and more efficient roadside test so we can test more people. It's about educating the public about the danger of driving on influence of illicit substances. Just as we've got the message about alcohol largely, you know, the vast majority of people won't drive if they're drinking. We need to get the message out there about the use of illicit substances. It's a challenge for us, and our constant vigilance in terms of reducing road trauma is something that we need to work as a community, state and federal level to achieve to real reduction. But I think there's a role for some national leadership on the issue and working across state boundaries and learning from each state jurisdiction's best approaches, and borrowing the ideas from each state and then applying them more nationally.
Now, your Labor counterpart, Anthony Albanese, has accused the government of significantly underspending on road safety issues like the Black Spots program and the heavy vehicles safety measures, and putting this funding back into the budget, essentially. How do you respond to that criticism?
Well, Mr. Albanese is wrong, and he knows he's wrong. Since his government came into power in 2014, there's been 17,000 projects completed through my portfolio. A lot of those have been small local road projects, Black Spot projects, heavy vehicle safety and productivity upgrades, the Bridges Renewal Program. And then there's been the mega projects like the Bruce Highway and the City Highway and the major projects in the city. So we are spending record amounts on infrastructure. The argument from a lot of people is we always need to do more. I'd generally accept that if I had more money at my disposal. I'm happy to spend on other important projects across the nation. But we're delivering everything we promised we'd deliver and some more in terms of since the election we've been announced the Western Sydney Airport. Major funding commitment there, which we'll talk about before, $8.4 billion in the budget. So we are getting on the job of delivering the road across our nation. And when you go out and drive a big highway or a city highway, and you see literally thousands of workers out there doing a great job for our nation, I'm pretty proud to see them getting on with that job.
This week, the Adani Coal Project has been in the news with a Four Corners program documenting charges of corruption, allegations of corruption against Adani. The rail line for the project has been flagged as potentially benefiting from the Northern Australia Infrastructure Fund. Considering these allegations of corruption and environmental destruction against the group. Is this project likely to gain approval, do you think?
Well, it's not for me to decide today what happens with the application that Arnie may make to the Commonwealth for funding support through the NAIF program. As my understanding of the project is that they will be seeking to review a dedicated rail line to get the coal to port, and that's what it seems to be that that load off the road line and on the road. But I haven't been directly involved in any discussions about the goal of that project. All I can say is that when we look at the energy needs of the world, right around the world, nations are building coal-fired power stations to lift their community out of poverty. India is a classic example of that. India is looking more to their poverty through the use of coal than any other country in modern history. We're selling our coal in the world, we're using coal in Australia for our baseload power and energy. I think the communities need for a calm and rational debate about the important role coal plays in the future of our nation. I absolutely support the need to be used in the building where it's appropriate, where it's affordable. At the same time, we have a competitive advantage in Australia against great natural resources. The key to jobs in our regional communities, but certainly key to the manufacturing sector being competitive on the world market. So I have no intention, in fact, I'm supportive of using Australian coal for the jobs and the commerce it creates, but also for like 15 people out of poverty in other parts of the world.
Do you know whether the Northern Australia Fund has consulted with Infrastructure Australia about Adani, as is required with larger projects?
I'm not aware of any conversation that occurred at this stage on the front. Gap in my knowledge, but I'm not going to be involved in the project.
Now, just staying with Queensland, we're expecting the Queensland election to be announced soon. How strongly do you think One Nation is likely to perform in that election?
Well, my view of One Nation is that the more its candidates and senators are exposed to scrutiny and questions of policy, the more they'll go off like a coal in the Queensland sun. When people start thinking about their policies and working way through the ones that before, they realise that One Nation is really good at identifying the problems, but doesn't really transfer any solutions. So, having said that, there's no doubt that populist appeal might attract some support in Queensland. But I think the more people closely scrutinise their policies, the more they realise they're actually going to have any message.
The Nationals have always been really worried about One Nation and have fought them in their first iteration. Do you think, again, the Nationals will really be called on to step up in this battle with One Nation?
So we're a party that's been challenged before, it's proven very resilient, and we're at our best when we're fighting for our community. So, we've got a great leader in Barnaby Joyce, we've got a strong team across the board. One of the great things about our party is we're very authentic, we have people who can be really good walks of life, we've got a cookie cutter production line, National Party, and we've quite a diversity in our room. We've had very robust debates as a result in our party room, but we stick together pretty closely too. So, we may have those debates in our party room, but we get out there and back our leader and back each other. So in terms of One Nation, One Nation to me will come and go again. I can understand why it has some appeal in the sense that it can say enough popular things at the right time, people will support you. But it becomes a challenge in political life. We actually have to find a solution. We have to be an alternative form of government, we have to have policies. And I'm afraid that One Nation's found wanting every time.
One reason why the Nationals were successful in the last election is that they distinguished themselves very much from Malcolm Turnbull's campaign. They went on their own, particularly local issues, and were not so much into innovation and the age of excitement. Would you anticipate next time that the Nationals will run also a very distinct campaign?
I think our campaign will be very similar next time. We'll be very much focused on what we've been able to deliver for regional Australia in our 2 terms in government. So, yes, we need to remind people we've done a pretty good job, and then we need to be bring forward probably what we need for the future. So, it will be very much a grassroots campaign, reminding people that we have a role to play, an important role to play in the federal government, and also that we have ideas and plans for the future. Now, if that's different to what our Liberal colleagues do, that's not really anything I worry about. I worry about I've been the best member of Gibson, and I can be top with many of my colleagues as possible in their seat, so that we have real influence in the future coalition government. So the more Nationals we have around the table, the more influence we can have on the decisions of the big region of Australia. You know, we may be ideologically, we may have many differences in our party room, but we do have a very shared passion for the geography of regional Australia that joins us quite strongly, and it means that when we're going to fight an issue, you know, we've got real love together.
You're one of a minority of Nationals who support same-sex marriage, and in the past you've got a bit of heat within your party over this. Are you still getting that sort of heat, and what do you think the result will be of the postal vote, especially in National Party seats?
But I took my position very seriously. I was respecting a lot of my views in the past, but I changed my mind. I'm supporting the people who continue to be genuinely offended in Australia. I think the fact that they're already seeing close to 60% of Australians having their standing with those debates is very interesting. It's a big indication of their decision to let the Australians be able to vote. I think there will be a resounding yes vote around the nation. Even flowing with my interest, obviously, some of the situations that are pretty strong on some of the regional areas. I don't think there'll be a division if Australia doesn't vote yes. I think there'll be one of the 50,000 of these divisions will vote yes. And I think that may surprise some of my colleagues to find that out from the field. But, this is me making predictions, and predictions aren't a good thing for politicians to make. So I think the mood is out there in the community. Now, regional Australia is not a conservative block of people might like to think. It's very diverse. Cosmopolitan nature, the large coastal towns that form part of the National Party electorate. So it's a very diverse and community we represent. I think by the long term, Australia are going to vote yes, and there's a phenomenon of a really, in a couple of years' time, people look back and listen to that with much to do about nothing. Yes, it's been expensive, but I think in terms of giving Australians a chance to have their say, trust in their expression, and opinion on different issues, it's been a good thing, and I'm looking forward to the result.
So you look forward to seeing some same-sex weddings in your electorate of Gippsland before Christmas?
Well, if you put it like that, Michelle, I have to put that into Gippsland. It's a beautiful place. It's a wonderful place for honeymoon. I'd encourage people to think about visiting my beautiful part of the world. And if the vote goes yes, legislation could be moved even quickly through the House of the Reform. I think we'll get support. If we're going to see when ceremonies and honeymoons occur, I'd like to see them in Gippsland.
Darren Chester, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all from our Conversations Politics podcast for now. We'll be back with another interview very soon.